Hi, and welcome to The Return with Stefan and Anna. The Return is the podcast which opens up the world of investing, making important information easier to understand and more interesting. Now, Anna and I are really excited about this episode, as it marks the first in our mini-series on property. As you'll know, if you've listened to the intro episodes, this is our main focus and passion in life. So, to be fair, we're a bit biased.
Yeah, we're definitely biased. Anyway, in this episode, I had the privilege of interviewing the CEO and founder of Inspired, one of the most exciting, innovative and fastest growing property investment and asset management companies in London. So if you like the idea of getting on or stepping up on the property ladder, but aren't sure you have enough for a deposit, or you're struggling with getting a mortgage, or if you're just keen to learn about innovations in the world of property, this interview is for you.
Just a quick word of warning here. There are a few bumps in the recording. Anna tells me this is Martin banging the desk with enthusiasm. Either way, it's a cracking interview. So over to Anna and Martin.
Martin Skinner runs one of the fastest growing property investment and asset management companies in London, focused on the residential market, and in particular in emerging high growth locations like Croydon and Sutton. He's had huge success both personally and with his current business, Inspired, with property investment and development. And I know from our previous conversations that it's been a real roller coaster, all the way from bankruptcy at the bottom end to awards, media attention, multi-million pound returns that the projects are currently receiving. So the GDV is about 500 million under management at the moment, and yep. You're focusing on a whole range of things. Why don't you give, in your own words, exactly what Inspired do?
Sure. Well, we're property specialists, and in particular residential, and in particular the niche micro strategies that I've actually just defined with British Property Federation as compact living. So these are individually mortgageable units, but we do hold blocks of them. Ideally suited to first-time buyers, so compatible with Help to Buy. So they're smaller than traditional residential apartments.
How small?
Typically between about 27 and 45 square metres for one and two beds. Actually, because of the way we design them more efficiently, they don't feel much smaller than typical apartments, but they can have a lower unit starting price, so much easier for first-time buyers to buy. Then there's co-living, which is typified by the collectives model. That is effectively student-style accommodation, purpose-built blocks. The units are even smaller than compact living. So we're talking, let's say, studios or bedsits between 12 and 20 square metres.
Okay.
So you can't mortgage them individually, but you can get commercial finance on the whole block. And because it's even more intensified, you can get a much higher yield than with typical PRS, private rented or professional rented sector, residential.
So in principle, it's better for the investor and for the people who can afford to live there.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
And they often have exceptional shared or communal living facilities as well, social spaces as we call them. And then the third strand is really where I started with property, which is shared living, i.e. HMOs, houses of multiple occupation, flat and house shares.
Okay.
Those are the three categories that we specialise in.
So for anyone who doesn't know what that is, just describe what the HMO model is.
So that's typically turning a three-bedroom family house in a town and city centre locations into a six-bed house share. So someone could just rent a room and then have access to a shared open-plan kitchen, dining, living space. So again, more affordable for the occupiers, but a greater return for the investor that owns the whole house.
Okay. So that's what you do in terms of the actual property. And a big focus more recently has been about different types of financing, indirect investment. So talk to me about what you do in the indirect investment space.
So really, as an investor developer, it's all about juggling the balance between capital and assets. So we have a strong capital raising function in the business, and we have a strong acquisition, delivery, sales and lettings side to the business. On the capital side, we raise money for our projects through multiple routes. We, what, about 3 years ago, broke the world record for the largest ever peer-to-peer or crowd-funded property loan.
That's brilliant.
With Green Dragon House and through LendInvest.
How big was that?
I think it was about 4.3 or 4.6 million at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were all paid back 6 months later with a great return. We've also put together a mini bond offering. There are a few of these out in the market these days. I think it's well worth having a look at ours. Typically, people are offering somewhere between about an 8 and a 12% per annum return.
Okay.
It's a professional, sophisticated investors only. So people have got to be qualified before they can get any information.
Right. Okay. So that's the main difference between the peer-to-peer and the bond is that who can access it.
Correct. Mm. Yeah. In addition, we are looking to put together the first co-living REIT.
Mm-hmm. So that's a real estate investment trust.
Yes. Yeah.
And that means?
That means it would be probably it would be a private REIT initially, but then we would list it once we've got to, say, 250 million of seed assets.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to a number of very large investors that would come in with a cornerstone investment of at least 50 to 100 million of equity. Then we would go out and raise a lot more money through corporate finance,
mm-hmm.
capital raising, placement agents, brokers.
Okay. So, and so the real estate investment trust is basically a structure for doing similar things, but it's shares rather than debt.
It's more suited to institutional, lower risk, lower return investors. The problem with residential, typically, for listing, and the reason why it tends to be private investors, buy-to-let markets boom, for example, mm. owner-occupiers, rather than institutional owners of residential, is because it typically achieves a much lower net yield. That's because it's structurally undersupplied. So in real terms, it tends to dramatically outperform on a value growth and income growth basis. And that means
residential.
Relative to everything else. But the cap rate, i.e. the yield on capital value, is much lower than institutional investors are used to achieving for property. So
okay.
they will tend to look at the net initial yield and say, right, commercial offices, let's say, are between 4 and 5, residentials, 2.5, maybe. Well, we'll go for commercial.
Okay.
And it's bigger lot sizes. However, student accommodation has been extremely successful and is now an institutionally accepted asset class in its own right, where residential isn't. So what we're looking to do is deliver the same kind of returns through the same kind of assets, as has been proved with the collective, and produce that for everyone else. So rather than it just the 18 being the 18 to 20 year old category, well, co-living can be for everybody. So typically it would be for 20 to 40 year olds. However, there is a very strong argument, and we have a partner with this who's probably the UK's foremost expert for retirement and
yep.
assisted living as well. So it's a good model. We're very excited about it.
So in general, the whole model is about reducing the unit sizes.
It's intensifying the occupation,
mm-hmm.
which intensifies, increases the rental yield
mm.
cost, and it, at the same time, improves the affordability for the individual occupiers. So it's a win-win.
One of the major problems in the UK market has been this accessibility and affordability. And so many people have been priced out as land values have risen faster than incomes. And you seem to have a big message as a business that is around opening up access in the property market, whether it's for investors or first-time buyers, to actually access property assets. I suppose, talk to me about what the problem is and how indirect investment, for example, peer-to-peer loans, can actually solve that for potential investors who want property but can't afford a whole one themselves.
Sure. I mean, the structural issue with the market, I kind of identified 15 years ago when I started.
Mm.
I did a bit of research around what people could afford for their housing costs in London at the time, we're UK-wide now. In 2002, about 95% of the working population of London could afford about £500 a month. And yet, 100% of the supply side of the market, so take your one-bed flats and up, would cost you considerably more than
yeah.
£500 a month
to
rent or buy with a mortgage. So really, only 5% of the demand side could afford 100% of the supply side of the equation.
Mm.
And the market has only been producing 50% of the stock that the growing population requires. But that's just an efficiency thing. People don't need to use all of that space all of the time. So it's a bit like the uberification of the residential accommodation market. You've seen it in serviced offices with co-working. The same will definitely happen with co-living. And then it's just a case of whether it's rental or purchase. So we've got solutions for both.
Mm.
The planners who allow or refuse schemes and decide on the viability and the taxation of schemes that developers produce. They don't really understand this yet. However, the student sector has led the way and demonstrated how it can be done successfully for all parties and stakeholders. And co-living is basically the same thing for everybody else. Micro flats, compact living for sale, are exactly what the government wants to deliver, affordable solutions for young professionals, and they're much more viable across the board. So it's possible to produce a much higher quality product, but still be more affordable and generate a higher return. So it works all round.
Because that's on the consumption side. What about on the investment side in terms of accessibility and affordability for potential investors?
Yeah, so I think the government's made some terrible mistakes in buy-to-let, moving the taxation and regulatory boundaries quite dramatically and very frequently. And I read something in the FT the other day that buy-to-let stock is reducing. So not only are far fewer people buying buy-to-let homes from new developers, but they're actually selling their existing stock because of the loss of mortgage relief, which can turn slightly cash flow positive properties into negative cash flow properties just with taxation change. They're having to pay tax on money that they haven't actually made as a profit, which is crazy. I think the government will have to reverse that. They had to in Ireland, for example, when they tried a similar thing. 7 years later, they had to reverse it. However, in the meantime, it does make sense to provide other avenues for investors to come in.
Yes.
Buy-to-let isn't such a good structure anymore. I still think it is, by the way.
But anyway, not everyone can afford a whole property.
Correct, yeah.
Especially not in the local market.
Yeah, so crowdfunding, or peer-to-peer, either debt or equity purchases of homes.
So just very briefly for anyone who doesn't know, crowdfunding is equity, peer-to-peer lending is debt.
In general, it's not quite that simple, but approximately, I would say, yeah.
And either way, how that works is you get a little chunk of a project that someone else is doing or a portfolio that someone else is holding, and you access a proportion of the returns.
Through a platform, generally.
Through a platform. Like, and anyone can get involved.
The FCA is regulating the space, though, so there are regulatory hurdles and qualification criteria that people either have to already or will have to go through, both on the investor and the provider sides. Yeah, we've tried to do this for rented residential. We did it through simple equity, and frankly, the first attempt didn't quite work. I think probably because the total returns looked relatively low compared to other more speculative or opportunistic offerings. So we're just tuning that, and we're hoping to come back with another version which would be leveraged and would therefore offer a higher return. The issue with leveraging crowdfunded properties is that the banks that provide the debt find it very difficult to get their heads around having so many different owners of the asset. So we're still working on that.
But you make a very interesting point, which is that a lot of the propositions that are available on crowdfunding platforms or peer-to-peer lending, whether that's in property or even in other spaces, a lot of them look incredibly attractive because they're marketed as such. But actually, there's other stuff behind it, which is the risk. Maybe they didn't talk about it as much as you would if you were your own investor making a decision.
Yes.
People tend to focus on the story and the hype and not so much
on the downside.
The security there, you're leveraging it up and holding it or not leveraging it up and holding it. It's very much more secure than if you're doing a huge development that's subject to planning.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not so sure that full planning risk is ideally suited to crowdfunding. Well, it can be.
Again, not everyone understands that. So if you've got an opportunity, a piece of land, and you're applying for planning to build 8 houses on it or 80 houses on it, however many it is, but you raise money on that from people telling them that you're going to make a 300% return.
Yeah.
But actually your planning doesn't come through, then there's absolutely no return. Or your planning comes through with less, then there might be a lower return. And they would typically market the 300% return rather than telling you that there's a chance it might not come through, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it depends on what the hold costs are and what the possibility is that if it's delayed for years through planning, which is entirely possible,
very likely, possible in this system,
then what happens? Planning risk is okay if you've got the time and the runway to get it eventually or to trade it on with an alternative use, for example. I like buying sites that already have buildings on them. That's my preference. Sure. Because the planners can't stop moving buildings if there's one there already. So there's always an intrinsic value to it, whereas a blank piece of land, the planners may never let you get anything on it.
Are there any other kind of major impacts, aside from regulation, that affecting opening up or even closing down aspects of the property investment world?
Yeah, regulations in property and financial services can be extremely onerous, and the goalposts can be moved a lot. It's a little bit like planning. The regulators will often tell you what you can't do, but they won't tell you exactly what you can do. They'll just say maybe, and then you've got to kind of go for the worst possible case to make sure that you're compliant. So be very careful when you're setting up any kind of structure for pooled investments, and make sure you've got the best lawyers, accountants, and other advisors is my tip.
And what about the other end though? I mean, do you need to be thinking about that if you're looking at investing in a peer-to-peer loan or a crowdfunding?
Yeah, I think you should look for relatively well-known brands, as you would do in any high street.
I think that's difficult because they're all so new. I mean, these platforms have come up in the last, what, 5 years, really?
True, yes.
How do you know what's credible and what's long-term?
Well, I would say with us, for example, we've produced homes, people are living in them, and hundreds of them. So it's possible to see that there are physical assets there at the end of it. That's something that I would recommend investors.
So you're then looking at the developer or the provider at the other end. Does it make a difference what the platform is? So, for example, you mentioned Simple Equity earlier, but there's all sorts of other different platforms available. Does that make any difference from an investor's perspective?
Yeah, I think it does, because if you use a similar approach, so you look for the platforms that have not just raised the money for the strategies or businesses that they've been raising for, but where the businesses have actually delivered something, as opposed to it just being pie in the sky stuff that may or may not ever get off the ground. Obviously, there will be failures, and that doesn't mean that the platform is a failure. However, looking to make sure that there have been a reasonable number of successes, products, assets, things have been produced by those businesses.
And I guess in a sense, that's down to the individual. What does success look like? Because if I looked at a platform and half of them had been a success and half of them hadn't, I might say I probably won't invest because I'm very risk averse. Whereas there's other more risk tolerant people who would see that as actually quite good. And I suppose that's where the property crowdfunding space differs from, for example, if you're looking at tech startups, where you know you expect 9 out of 10 to fail, and you get that one really great return per year or whatever per 10 that you've invested in.
I mean, there are gold rushes in all sorts of different subsectors, aren't there? Cryptocurrency seem to be the latest gold rush. I think that is going to transform the banking world, but it does scare me that any number of new currencies can be launched, and then what happens to the old one? With things like that, we look to use those technologies to deliver a more efficient product and service, but we don't look to launch businesses that are just focused on that.
Once they're proven,
So the collective will accept Bitcoin rents, and that's a nice, easy way to pay rent now. But I haven't invested in a Bitcoin or cryptocurrency business. Sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I don't like our stuff to be cutting edge or bleeding edge. It's a little bit like Apple. They didn't really launch things with the latest technology first. They rounded off the sharpest edges on it and then just brought out the most usable version of it. So that's what I like us to do.
Yeah,
so,
that makes sense.
You know, we've got smart home technology, but they're things like gigabit internet. With the smart home technology, we use Nest, which is the smart thermostat system, actually started by one of the main guys from Apple originally and funded to the tune of $5 billion by Google. So there's plenty of money there to make sure that it continues to be delivered for many, many years and it's supported properly. And it just makes it much easier to set temperature at home. It does it automatically for you based on sensors in the radiators and software in your phone.
Are there any other cool tech things that you're using that have been proven in your development?
Well, we've got smart switches coming, and we're looking at smart lock systems. And we've got smart delivery locker systems as well in our blocks.
So we talked about how, going back to indirect property investment into the bonds, the REITs, the peer-to-peer, the crowdfunding, about how the different returns compare. So bonds possibly offering around about 8 to 12%, REITs offering a relatively low return, but being quite a stable income.
We're targeting a sort of 5 to 6% per annum distribution.
So who would typically hold a REIT that you're setting up?
Well, hopefully we'll get it to a large enough scale for mainstream institution investors.
So people could basically invest in these things, but it would be via their pension fund, and probably they wouldn't be making the decision.
Typically, yes. Yeah. But if we can get it to, say, $1 billion or more quickly, which is what it needs to be for it to be successful, I think, then it'll be listed on a mainstream stock exchange, mm-hmm. and anyone will be able to trade those units.
Mm-hmm. And that's the goal.
That's the goal.
And then going back to the other two options we discussed, the crowdfunding and the peer-to-peer, what are typical market returns? Not necessarily unique to you.
The likes of LendInvest through secured senior loans, I believe those would be anywhere between 5% and
secured senior, 5% and 8% secured senior loans.
It means that there is a charge against the property. Typically, if the asset is, say, 100,000, the senior loan on it would go up to 70% of that.
So this is an alternative to having a mortgage, right?
Yes, it effectively is a mortgage, but you're the owner of the mortgage security as opposed to being the owner of the property. So there's scope, therefore, for the asset to drop in value, in principle, by 30%, say, where you've got costs of taking possession and selling it on. So it's not quite that simple. But basically, there's room for some value to drop out of the property, and the senior lender can still secure their money back, or senior lenders.
So in principle, it's lower risk.
Yes. Yeah. That's around 5% to 8% per annum, I would say, generally.
And then crowdfunding can be presumably any kind of return. And it might be 100%, it might be 0%, right?
Yes. Yeah. The difference typically between the senior debt return, which is pure income, there is no capital value gain expected there, and equity investment in, for example, the REIT, there should, logically, be some value growth as well. So it wouldn't just be the income return. Mm-hmm. If it's a structurally undersupplied market, like residential and the different sort of hybrid versions of that, like student, co-living, etc., there should be capital growth as well, which made the total return significantly higher. But the risk is higher than with a debt structure.
And on that capital growth point, with the way things are going at the moment, right, we're having a little dip in the property market, in particular in London and in particular at the high end.
Yeah.
But with affordability considerations across the board, where do you see capital values going over, let's say, the next 10 years?
Yeah.
Are the fundamentals there for the same growth that we've had in, what, since 1952 when records began? It's been average of like doubling every 10 years.
10 yeah. years, yeah.
So that's what we've had, but what's going forward, fundamentals based?
Yeah, I think the market will still do very well over the medium term, 10 years. I think the capital growth will be very good in that time. I think it'll double again, roughly. But in the short term, with all of the immediate uncertainties, I think we're probably going to see more constrained growth for obvious reasons. Uncertainty means people tend to become a little bit more risk averse and sit on their hands. So we'll have probably slow growth. And in London, we might see some further value drops, particularly at the prime end of the market. I think where people really have to move into a home, you know, no one has to buy a £100 million home, but around the £150,000 to £300,000 category, if someone, for example, buys one of our flats with Help to Buy, they'll be paying a mortgage service charge and utility cost that saves them somewhere between about a third and a half of their rental equivalent. So it makes sense to do that. And similarly, if the values are static or drop a bit, then, and taxation doesn't suit people to invest quite so much, buy-to-let changes, then it's extremely likely that supply will drop. And in a market that's already structurally undersupplied in London last year, supply dropped by about 35% as compared with the previous
supply of rental property or new homes. Okay.
And then you've also got the movement for existing rental homes to be traded out of and typically sold back into the owner-occupier market. So I think while the market's still nervous, rents probably won't go up that rapidly. But as soon as a little bit of insecurity starts to reduce and landlords of existing homes get comfortable again that the income's there, I think you're going to see rents flying up because prices are a function of supply and demand. If values are going to be held back somewhat, but supply drops, then it's more likely to be rents, which is why we're looking to move into larger lumps of rented residential or residential type co-living assets.
So larger lumps, how many units would you have in one block or building?
Well, the Old Oak scheme, which is currently being sold, is 550 units, for example.
Who buys that? Don't tell me confidential information, but you know, what's a typical buyer look like for those kind of assets?
Yeah, so it's kind of sovereign wealth funds, institutional investors like pension funds,
yeah,
and insurance companies, private equity, family offices, and individual investors that have got deeper pockets than your typical buy-to-let investor, and therefore they want more manageable blocks.
But 550 is at the top end of the scale.
Yeah, so student accommodation typically ranges from, say, about 50 units to about 1,000 in a single asset. So maybe an average of about 200, 250 per scheme. With our co-living REIT, should we get it off the ground, still in the planning stage, I would expect to be buying maybe 3 or 4 buildings a year, probably 100 to 200 units per scheme initially, something like that, and scale up from there. But we would be buying other people's. So we won't typically be taking development risk.
Because you can't.
Just because with that sort of listed vehicle, it makes more sense to have a lower risk strategy. We'll still be doing our private developments, which carry more risk, where we've got more opportunistic investors and looking to achieve a much higher return too.
Okay. So all of these indirect property investment vehicles, so whether that be P2P, crowdfunding, bonds, they all change the way people can access property. And there's a massive advantage in the sense that investors can potentially diversify across. Let's say you've got a sophisticated investor, they can get a bit of bond, they can get a bit of crowdfunding, they can get a bit of peer-to-peer, and they're a bit more diversified. So with, let's say, £100,000, they can be investing in 3 different things. And they don't have to do any of the work, which is the massive advantage, because property is hard work when you're at the coal face. Are there any other kind of big advantages to actually, for an investor, looking at indirect property investment?
Yeah, I'm not so keen on the sort of diversification argument.
Okay.
I think Warren Buffett said, you're better off putting all your eggs in one basket and watching them very carefully.
Yeah.
But all of these different models for structures like peer-to-peer, crowdfunding,
etc. Back to Warren Buffett, what Warren Buffett said, though, he typically put all his eggs in one basket and then had an influence on controlling it, which you can't do via these vehicles.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I still personally like owning...
You can, but the average investor can't.
That's my favourite.
Yeah.
The average investor, however, can come into various different structures with a smaller sum if they want to, but I would still make sure they do a lot of research as if they were buying one whole property themselves and on the operator as well as the asset. For me, these offer just a more efficient solution. So the structures make it quicker and easier for investors to come in and out. A lot of the transaction will be processed online, for example, rather than the 4 months that it seems to take to get a bank account set up for a company with any mainstream retail bank. That's bonkers. You know, these things you can transact very quickly, moments online. So I see it as an efficiency for both capital raising and for investors to access assets,
as opposed to
being specifically a diversification player.
And what about the inefficiencies, though? Because you're paying someone else. Let's say I'm paying company X via a peer-to-peer loan to manage, you know, I'm paying peer-to-peer fees, or at least they're being paid for as some part of my investment. I'm also paying the people who are doing the work. How do I know they're being efficient?
Well, those fees should be lower through crowdfunding type platforms than you would typically pay, let's say, with the old style financial advisor with a big commission and a platform and an operator generally and a wrap provider. Whereas with the online platforms, you're generally paying them something and then you've got the asset provider. So it's peer-to-peer.
Yeah.
So investor to provider.
Okay, so there's a big efficiency argument there then.
Yes. Yeah.
What about the disadvantages? So we talked a little bit about risk. And I guess in a way, if you're more direct to the operator, you've got greater access to the risks that they've got access to, in a sense. Are there any other kind of disadvantages or things that people should be aware of if they're considering this?
Well, it's all relatively new. So the unknowns aren't really known yet. So I think just got to bear that in mind. And hence, do your own research and don't rely on anyone else. I still like to. I've got a team of 45 people here. But I still like to go and look at every single property and go through all the plans myself. Third-party information is still third-party information. Better to do some research directly if you can.
I agree, and I guess the issue is, you know, when things are made very easy, it's brilliant that they're being made very easy, but actually that can lead a potential investor to make shortcuts because it looks easy.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, but I think also, you know, individual responsibility. People can choose where they put their money more directly these days, and people can do their own research as opposed to blindly assuming that an advisor is going to do it for them, when often the advisor has less self-interest in doing that research than the investor themselves would. So I think giving investors more power to make more decisions will result in better decisions. Mm.
The incentives are at least with the person who's making the decision, whereas previously, I suppose you have, with the financial advisor model, in a way you have a divorce between control and the actual investor. Okay. So if I'm an investor, a potential investor, and I've got a pot of money and I like the idea of investing in property, but I don't have time to do it myself and I don't have enough to buy a whole property, how would I decide what to invest in? You talked a bit earlier about the fact that some things are open to some people, not everything's open to everyone.
Yeah.
How would I set my strategy?
I think work out what level of risk they're comfortable with and what level of return they're looking for, and then make their decisions from there.
What return are you looking for? Where are you starting from? Where are you going to? And then find a way of doing it.
And maybe have a blend of strategies. So maybe they have some higher risk capital they can speculate with, and have some lower risk capital that they want a steady return from. And then the kind of steady return portfolio of cash, they should look for things like the secured loans. They should look for just rented residential. And then the higher risk stuff, that tends to be more the development transformational capital.
And that's the stuff that looks amazing, but
may or may not
happen. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I guess I'm the same investor looking at potentially investing in one of these options. How do I learn more about it? Do I just have to do my research, or are there any great kind of resources that one can use?
I think it's more direct research by the investor at the moment. I'm sure more research-driven platforms will come out, sort of, compare the market type platforms, but a lot of them are more mature ones. Those are quite biased too.
Yeah.
So I think it comes down to individual research and networking as well. Although a lot of these platforms are online, I think it's worth actually meeting the people behind them personally.
I think that's a really good tip.
Yeah.
You get a much better gauge of whether you can trust someone with your money if you meet them in person. So is there anything that I should have asked you about your business, about what you're doing in the property space, and about how investors can get involved that I haven't asked you?
A good question would be, when's the next event so we can actually go and see some of the physical assets?
Okay, I think that's a great question.
That's the worst one to ask me because I haven't got an event planned yet.
There are events, though, people can find them on your website, absolutely. Right?
Which is www.inspiredassets.com and www.inspiredhomes.uk.com. And we're all over social media as well.
Cool.
If you look for Martin Skinner, Inspired Asset Management, Inspired Homes, we're there.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Anna. Pleasure.
Thanks for that, Anna and Martin. And thank you for listening to this episode of The Return. I loved this interview. I know Martin personally, and he's a great guy, and Inspired is a great company. What we found really exciting about the Inspired model is that it solves an industry problem for the end user, making things more affordable for potential homeowners and renters, as well as benefiting the investor involved.
Yeah, I also love hearing from investors who've experienced real highs and lows. The fact that Martin has made and then lost and then made a fortune again is really inspiring for anyone who's been through a struggle, which is most of us. It's evidence of two really important ideas. Firstly, as investors, none of us can expect things to go well all the time. It's never all upside. Secondly, it's possible to get back up, even if you've had a real low. Thanks for listening. And as ever, you can find out more on our website, thereturnpodcast.com, Instagram, the.return.podcast, Facebook, The Return Podcast group and page, and please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you've enjoyed or learned something from the podcast. Your reviews help other people find the podcast, as Apple Podcasts loves reviews.